Today on KPR Presents, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas. I'm Kay McIntyre. Each year, the State Library of Kansas selects 15 books as Kansas Notable Winners. In the second of a two-part series, we'll hear from the authors of many of those books, including fiction, nonfiction, poetry, young adult literature, and more. It's my favorite show of the year, a chance to read some good books, meet the authors, and give some books away. Later this hour, find out how you can win a Kansas Notable book. The Kansas Notable Book winners were honored at the Kansas Book Festival on September 10, 2016. I met up with many of the Kansas Notable winners at the festival in Topeka, including Scott Martell. He's the author of The Madman and the Assassin, The Strange Life of Boston Corbett, The Man Who Killed John Wilkes Booth. Scott, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, and thanks for the interest and for having me.
It may surprise many of our listeners. It surprised me that there was any connection between the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and Kansas. And we'll get to the Kansas connection in a minute, but let's start out talking about Boston Corbett. Who was this eccentric little man?
He was an eccentric little man. He was born in England, came here as a young kid with his father, moved to New York, became an apprentice as he got older, an apprentice silk hat finisher. And they used mercury in those days, mercury vapor, part of the processing for the felt. And he inhaled a whole bunch of it. And I'm sure you've heard the phrase, mad as a hatter. Yep, that's where it came from. So he spent a lot of time in New York and other East Coast cities working in the hat trade, got married. His wife died tragically young. That sort of sent him off the deep end into the bottom of a whiskey barrel. He got saved by some teetotaling evangelist in New York City. They sort of wrapped him up, almost the way it's been described, almost like they kidnapped him, and sobered him up and proselytized at the same time and had an epiphany. And at the end of that process, I'd become a deep, deep believer and a zealot's the only way to describe him. I mean, street preaching. He did his day job to earn money to do the street preaching and save people like himself. He'd go out and find a drunk on the street, bring him back to his rooms, sober him up, get him a job, get him on the street, kick him out, go find another one. And he was using all of his income for that, as well as borrowing money from friends, fellow faithful, to do this kind of stuff. So he was really living the life that he thought he should as a Christian.
Then what happened with the advent of the Civil War?
The guy he was working for was supposed to, he was in a National Guard unit. He was supposed to be called up. And in that era, you could buy your way out. So he paid Corbett to take his place. And Corbett volunteered in one of the New York Cavalry. It was the 12th Cavalry at that point. And he spent most of the Civil War. He did four different enlistments, spent most of the Civil War in the Union Army. And that included 4 months in the Andersonville prison, that notorious prison in Georgia, which was less a prison than an open-air stockade that held tens of thousands of men at any given point. Lots of pestilence, lots of starvation, lots of illness, and it broke Corbett's health. I mean, he maintained his sanity, but he was a physical wreck at the end of that. And that dogged him through the rest of his days.
How did his stint in the Army carry him to that fateful night when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated?
He had been released from Andersonville, had healed enough to get back to active duty, so he rejoined his cavalry unit. The assassination happened. Everybody on the Union side in Washington was trying to find John Wilkes Booth. They knew it was him. He was hiding in a pine woods for a while and then wound up holding up at a tobacco farm. And just by pure happenstance, Corbett's unit was the one that went to the right farm and found him hiding in a tobacco barn, storage drying shed. And they found him in the middle of the night, and that was the end of John Wilkes Booth.
Would you like to read that passage?
I would love to. I happen to have it queued up. So they were standing, the soldiers had surrounded the barn knowing that Booth was in it, and Booth had been accompanied by a guy named David Harold, who had already left the barn. He had said he was giving up. He wasn't part of this. He just wanted to get out. He was part of it, but he wanted to get out. So at this point, it's just Booth in the barn, and the cavalryman and a couple of private detectives were with them, had started a fire at the back of the barn to try to flush him out of the barn. And this is happening at like 2 or 3 in the morning. And earlier, Corbett had offered to go in by himself and bring Booth out. an act of bravado that everybody rejected. At the side of the barn, the sergeant who had offered to take Booth and Harold alone kept a steady gaze on the injured actor through a hand-wide gap between two planks. The sergeant was a slender man, about 5 feet, 4 inches tall, with longish dark hair parted in the middle and slicked back behind his ears. He wore a scraggly beard and had soft brown eyes. He had served with the Union Army off and on since the start of the war, and steadily since late 1863. He'd earned a reputation for religious zealotry that at one point landed him in the stockade for calling out a superior officer who swore while dressing down his troops. But that deep faith had also helped him survive 4 months in the notorious Andersonville prison. Only the sergeant himself knew exactly what was running through his mind at that moment. Flames were crawling up inside the back wall of the barn, illuminating Lincoln's killer. Doherty and Baker, the two detectives, were standing on the far side of the partly open barn door. Soldiers were spaced about 10 yards from each other around the barn to ensure Booth couldn't flee. In the flickering light of the growing flames, the sergeant saw Booth raise his rifle toward the open door and the soldiers and detectives beyond. He believed the killer was about to kill again, so the right-handed sergeant steadied his gun on his opposite forearm, took careful aim through the gap at Booth's shoulder, and fired. The soldier would later credit or blame Providence for the decision to shoot and for the path the bullet took. It only had a few yards to travel, but it yawed a bit from its intended mark and hit Booth at the left base of the skull, shattering the fourth and fifth cervical vertebrae and severing the spinal cord within, then tore out on the other side. Booth collapsed, paralyzed, mortally wounded. Within seconds, Doherty, Conger, and some of the soldiers pulled him from the blazing building and moved him into the yard, and then as the fire roared and grew, placed the assassin on the house porch, where he clung to life for about 3 hours. The sergeant who fired the fatal shot was named Boston Corbett, and with that guiding hand of Providence, his troubled life became the stuff of legend, infatuation, and invention, and eventually institutionalization, for Sergeant Boston Corbett was mad as a hatter.
That's The Madman and the Assassin, The Strange Life of Boston Corbett, the Man Who Killed John Wilkes Booth by Scott Martell. Scott, let's jump forward a couple years to 1878, when Corbett moves to Kansas. What brought him here? And describe his time in Kansas.
He was broke is what brought him here. His health was shot. The silk hat industry had become, for economic reasons, nobody bought silk hats anymore. They were replaced in the fashion world by felt hats. So he couldn't make a living. He had a church, but he couldn't make enough money at that to keep himself going. He had asked the government for an appointment as a postmaster in Camden, never got a response. A friend of his, and this is conjecture, the guy named Joseph Whitehead, he had known in Andersonville, he had an 80-acre homestead in Cloud County. And the homestead next to his had not been claimed. And Corbett found out about it. You have to assume Whitehead is the one who told him about it. So Corbett came out, looked at the property, went back to Camden, made one last appeal to try to stay there, failed, packed up a few belongings, and began heading west and wound up out there. So the guy who had grown up in New York City and spent his life as a an itinerant silk hat maker was now going to be a farmer in Kansas. And there was a reason why those 80 acres were unclaimed. It's somewhat rocky terrain, very little of it's tillable. So the guy who would be a farmer went to a place he really couldn't farm.
Scott, we're doing this interview in the Kansas State Capitol, and coincidentally enough, for a short time, Boston Corbett worked as an assistant doorkeeper to the Kansas House of Representatives. It was a short-lived appointment. Tell us why.
It was. First, I did a reading at the book festival today in the very chamber that he had been assigned as the doorkeeper in, which is just kind of a rush after doing all that
That's
work.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. The Union soldier veterans were a fairly mutually supportive group, and they figured out that he was out of cash. I mean, he finally got a military pension of $8 a month, I think it was, but it wasn't enough to keep him going. And so a fellow veteran had recently been elected to the House of Representatives, and he finagled the appointment as, I think it was the third doorkeeper or something like that. And in that era, he was allowed to have his gun and his knife with him, which in retrospect was a bad idea. He was mentally ill for most of his adult life, the latter part of his adult life. I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, but it almost seems like a bipolar disorder or manic depression. He'd be relatively okay for a while and then get very paranoid and delusional about people trying to steal his land and his money and stuff. So when he started as the doorkeeper, he was in one of his better moods, and he was sort of the celebrity. Everybody wanted to shake the hand of the man who avenged Lincoln. But then he went into a dark place and began thinking people were laughing at him. He was very slight in build, very effeminate in appearance, and when people said he looked like a woman, it would sort of send him off the deep end. And one morning before the session began, he oddly in that time was helping the African-American janitors clean the floors, sweep the floors before the day session. So he had a friendship with some of these guys. And he was in this dark mood and heard them laughing and thought they were laughing at him. And walked up on them with his revolver drawn, and that started several hours worth of showdowns, which no gun was ever shot, but people kept trying to approach him. They finally kind of waited him out. They kind of contained him. He was moving around a bit different places and waited for an unguarded moment when his gun was tucked away and jumped him and wrestled him to the floor. And he like didn't really react to that. He says, you know, you're a jolly bunch of fellows or something like that. Took him to jail. The next day he had a sanity hearing before a probate judge. All the guys who were involved in the legislative stuff the day when he pulled the gun, testified against him. He did some cross-examination, which was nonsensical about conspiracy theories, and then did his own monologue about all the people out to get him. And so the judge had, it was an easy decision, and they sent him to the mental institute at Topeka State Hospital.
Tell me about the sad and mysterious end of his life.
Nobody really knows what happened to Boston Corbett. He was there for, I don't know the dates in front of me, for the better part of a year, if not longer. And in that era, the administrator lived on the grounds. The administrator had a young son. And these were mentally ill people, but not inmates, so they had a fair amount of freedom to roam around. And Corbett was out walking around the grounds in a parade of other inmates. They were inmates, even though it wasn't a jail. And he saw this kid ride up on a pony. And Corbett loved ponies. He had a favorite pony named Billy back in Cloud County. Saw a kid ride up on a pony and tie it up and go up into the building to see the son of the administrator, who was a friend of his. So Corbett suddenly decided to slow down and smell the roses. So he's like looking at plants as the parade of folks go by. And when enough distance opened up, he bolted for the horse, untied it, got on it, and took off. And that's the last anybody in Topeka ever saw Boston Corbett. He wound up in, and you'd have to know the pronunciation, as a West Coaster, Neodacia.
Neodacia.
There. He wound up there. A friend of his was there. A friend of his from Andersonville. And so we went to that guy's house and spent a couple, better part of 2 days there. And he had already deposited a bank draft of $15 at a bank in Concordia. I think Thatcher, his friend, had done that. So he gets there and he tells him he's going to go to Mexico. And he writes the bank draft to Thatcher's brother, I think it was, who gave him $15 in cash and got on the train. And that's the last anybody saw of him. So who knows where he is?
That's Scott Martell, the author of The Madman and the Assassin, The Strange Life of Boston Corbett, the Man Who Killed John Wilkes Booth. It's just one of the 2016 Kansas Notable books we're featuring on today's KPR Presents. We've got a copy of The Madman and the Assassin to give away. Find out how you can win this or another Kansas Notable book later this hour. Dana Bowman of Lindsberg is the author of Bottled, A Mom's Guide to Early Recovery. It's a raw account of one woman's journey from alcohol abuse to sobriety.
When I went into recovery, I was writing at the time. I was writing freelance work, doing freelance work. But, you know, obviously when recovery happens, or maybe not obviously to all the listeners, but it kind of takes over. It's like the most important thing in your life. And I was really focused on it, and it sort of consumed me. But then after the fact, when I had a couple of months of recovery in, I got contacted by the publisher, CRP, Central Recovery Press, and they asked me to write and for them, write a book for them. And I just thought at the time, kind of blissfully, oh, wonderful, I've always wanted to write a book, and just started in on it. And boy, was I surprised at how it was almost like I was going through recovery again, that early stage all over. So, but which in many ways was a good thing. I mean, it was grinding and difficult, but it was amazingly healthy and helpful for me too, so.
I keep going back to the word raw, but it's a very raw account of what it's like to be in recovery, but it's also incredibly funny.
Here's how I explain the funny part of it, because some would say this is too serious of a topic to be funny about. But I think that life is funny, and that, you know, Shakespeare will tell you that tragedy and comedy go together very well. And to me, humor takes us all down. It's kind of the leveler. It brings everybody down to the same page. And I just really don't know even how to speak in a way that's not going to access humor, because to me, that's what, you know, kind of keeps the soul spark going. And I write about him quite a bit in my book. My brother, who died from this disease, was hilarious. And the only problem with that is he used his funny sometimes to cover up a lot of pain. And I use my funny to uncover that pain. And I think that that's helping me heal and recover, and hopefully helping others too. So, yeah.
So I told you I thought there were two surprising things in this book. One was how funny it was, but the other was how many of the lessons, and I use that in air quotes, but how many of the lessons that you speak of are not just limited to people in recovery. There are things that I think probably every young mom can attest to or can identify with.
I have at the end of each chapter kind of a tongue-in-cheek top 10 list for things. I did that because I love top 10 lists, and I always love Dave Letterman, and I always like to use those. So some of them are a little bit sarcastic, but they really do have a point. And a lot of the top 10 lists, I ended up looking back at them and thinking, you know, this isn't all about, you know, just sobriety and not drinking. I think there's one chapter called It's Hard to Be Happy. And it talks about how sometimes we, and especially the moms, you know, in this day and age, the Pinterest mom is all out there with her pretty pictures and her cute little, oh my gosh, her mason jars and her, what's that stuff that they use all the time? The muslin, and, you know, I just don't get it. It's, everything is so darn cute. Can't even drink with a straw anymore unless it's like a cute straw, which doesn't make sense to me. I don't even use straws. Anyhow, so we have these moms that have these expectations about what life is supposed to look like, and we're not happy, you know? A lot of us are miserable, falling apart on the inside, and so I have a lot of stuff in here that kind of pokes at that and tries to unwrap it, and of course kind of makes fun of it and laughs at it. And you know, when I go back, I even talk about my pets and what they have done for our lives and things like that. And it is kind of crazy how the book covers a lot of ground. I guess I have a lot to talk about, so that's good.
One of the things you talk about is the power of changing just one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I just reread that chapter, and I thought to myself, boy, you need to go back to that. I had forgotten. You know, when we perfectionists get in our zone of, I must fix it all, and I kind of find myself doing this in terms of, like, cleaning the house. I could overdo it, and I'll find myself scrubbing the bottom of my refrigerator vegetable bin when really I should just be throwing some laundry in, you know? And I'm going to clean the entire house from ceiling to, you know, floor. It can be very overwhelming. And, you know, just that one thing, if you find yourself unhappy or stuck or in a rut, it was something I learned through my 12-step meetings. Just put down on your to-do list, whether it's actually written or not, but for me, I love lists, so I love to check it off. Just put down one thing to do today, not 10, not 15, one thing. And that one thing to change, or make sure it's something different that you haven't done before. And so see how that kind of, you know, messes with you or maybe recalibrates stuff. And I kind of see it as like, if you're going to the same doctor for 20 years and you still have the same problems, you know, try a different doctor and see how that goes. And it might not work and it might not be perfect, but it's just a one thing, you know, just try one thing today. So I sometimes can mutter that just one, because it's so hard to not want to fix the world, you know, and your children and your house and your husband and all of it, but just one thing.
Dana, can I get you to read an excerpt from your book?
Sure. I have a section here, actually, that I found just now, and it's from that chapter that I referred to, How to Survive Being Happy. And I want to backtrack and give you an explanation. It, I had just been sober at this point in the book for a little bit, not long, maybe probably about 2 months. So I was a tender little thing, and I had just received in the mail a wedding invitation. And the wedding invitation sent me into almost, I want to say, like, emotional explosion land. But let me read it and I'll explain. So I'm looking at the invitation and I'm thinking to myself, how dare he invite us? Does he not know how hard this will be for me? Perhaps it's fortunate that Ryan did not know. That's the gentleman getting married. Poor man, all he did was have the gall to invite me to witness a marriage to his sweetheart. I had now cycled up to anger and talking to myself, walking in a loop between our dining room and the kitchen, muttering and holding the invitation like it was evidence from a crime scene. I said, I can't do weddings, as I stared at the paper. I can't do weddings. And that's when I realized, I can't do weddings. This means I'm not normal. This means my life will be forever awkward and scary, because weddings will be, I am sure, happening all over the place now. All our happy little friends will start hooking up everywhere like romantic rabbits, and I will have to contend with all this wedding bliss. And in that moment, in my kitchen, I hated everyone who ever fell in love. Love is stupid. It just means people want to celebrate and then push drinks into your hands, practically forcing you to celebrate all that mushiness right along with them. I don't like celebrations. I hate life. I cried a little bit more and conceded I was the Grinch of everything. I walked out into our front porch and contemplated the most depressing thing ever. I wouldn't be able to toast my New Year. And Halloween! No big pictures of margaritas there either. I couldn't see it. A dry Halloween. It seemed like such a fool's errand, all this dressing up in kitty costumes where there was no alcohol to make me feel comfortable with the tail and the whiskers and the lack of dignity. Plus, Halloween had strangers coming to our door. As an alcoholic, I hate opening doors, answering phones, signaling for packages, talking, being responsible. Basic interaction. How was I supposed to do life if life included all these fun things? Fun things had to be garnished by wine. Otherwise, they were not fun things. And I would be so terribly aware that they should be fun, making me want to drink even more. And I would now have to do all sorts of events sober, anniversaries without romantic champagne. Anniversaries were supposed to be romantic and fun. Also the Super Bowl. How was I going to deal with the boredom, the cheering, the horrible halftime shows? Also, anything to do with Christmas. Christmas meant Bailey's and eggnog with a kick. And who really cares about the birth of baby Jesus when you can't drink mulled wine by the fire while listening to Josh Groban? We don't have a fireplace, and I never cared for mulled wine. Hot wine added an unnecessary step to drinking it. Thanksgiving! Thanksgiving meant traveling, which totally strung me out, so that meant martinis at my father-in-law's house, because he is a normie and happy to oblige. He even had those huge olives that are like a meal in themselves, so who needs dinner? I could eat a martini or maybe two, thank you. And what about if I land a book deal? How could I possibly not drink when that happens? Brace yourself for the irony. I got a book deal about not drinking, and yes, for about 5 seconds, I thought, yay, I am so happy. I must celebrate now. Wine! And I promptly smushed that thought with, you crazy. Call your mother instead. Post a picture of a kitty dancing on Facebook. Eat a Snickers. You don't drink anymore. Remember?
That's Bottled, A Mom's Guide to Early Recovery by Dana Bowman of Lindsberg. Thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure to be here.
If you're just joining us today on KPR Presents, it's the 2016 Kansas Notable Books, Part 2, the best new books by Kansans or about Kansas, selected by the State Library. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. If you missed last week's KPR Presents, Part 1 of our annual Kansas Notable Books program, it's now archived on our website, kpr.ku.edu. Just look under News and then KPR Presents. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu. While you're there, you can sign up for a chance to win a 2016 Kansas Notable Book. Thanks to many of the publishers, we've got several to give away. For a chance to win a book, look under Extra and then Available Giveaways. While you're at our website, consider making a gift to Kansas Public Radio. It's listener support that makes KPR Presents possible. Without it, we wouldn't be able to bring you locally produced programs that you enjoy and depend on. We're just about ready to kick off our fall membership drive. You can pledge now and know that you've done your part already. And thanks.
Our next book is 25 Years Among the Indians and Buffalo, a frontier memoir by William D. Street, edited by his great-grandson, Warren Street. Warren, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
The original title for this book was, I'm going to have to read this off, 25 Years Among the Indians and Buffalo, Personal Recollections of Adventure on the Plains as a Teamster, Soldier, Militiaman, Homesteader, Trapper, Buffalo Hunter, Scout, Guide, and Cowboy, on the plains of Kansas, Colorado, and Nebraska, with Custer in the Great Southwest, the Wichita Mountains of the Indian Territory, Oregon, Idaho, Wyoming, and the Black Hills of the Dakotas. Warren, was there anything your great-grandfather didn't do?
He did everything for about 2 years, and then he moved on. And he enjoyed all wildlife on the western plains, Kansas mainly, but Colorado and Nebraska as well.
So I've just given the very shorthand version of all the things he did over his career. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more. How would you describe your great-grandfather?
He was a true plainsman. He grew up he moved to Kansas when he was 10 years old, and he grew up in Jefferson County and went to school there. It's just north of Topeka. And when he got to the age of 16, the plains called to him. And the romance of being out and in the open was just very attractive to him. He signed on to a freighting company. These folks took wagon trains of freight out to the frontier, and that was the start of his life on the plains. There were times when he lived in towns. He was a storekeeper for a while, and he did land location. That was to help settlers find a homestead location that was good for them. But for the most part, he was out on the plains. He was a buffalo hunter. He was a fur trapper of trapped beaver and poisoned wolves for their hides. And he served a tour with Generals Sheridan and Custer in a famous winter campaign in 1868-69. He was a cowboy for a while, but most of his life was out, very independent living on the plains. And in 1878, he was involved with some military events with a group of Cheyenne Indians moving through Kansas on their way to return to their ancestral lands in Montana. And that kind of brought an end to this vagabond life that he had led. He settled down and purchased a newspaper in Oberlin, Kansas, became a state legislator, farmer, rancher. He was Speaker of the House. We're here in the Capitol building, and I noticed his photo on the wall by the chambers of the House, and he's the only speaker who has a P for his party affiliation. He was a populist during the heyday of the populist movement in Kansas. But the book that he published, or the book that he wrote, and now is available in published form, just covers his ages between about 17 and 27, when he was pretty much a ranger out on the buffalo range.
One of the amazing things about his story is that he kept a journal during that time, and he really documented what he was doing out on the plains. Tell me how that journal came into your possession and the story of how it came to be published 150 years later.
Yeah. He did keep this journal, and I'm sorry to say that that actual journal is not in my possession. He based the manuscript that I do have on his journal that he kept I think it's an unusual thing for a person on the plains to sit down at the end of a day of trapping or hunting and write down something about the day's events. But he did. He was a reader while he was out on the plains, and he talks every now and then about having a magazine or something like that, a book in his pack that he can read. The journal helped to inform his later writing. We think at about age 50 or so, he felt an urge to write down the details of his young life. He consulted this journal and then, I think, talked to friends who had been out on the Buffalo Range with him, tried to put together things from public records that helped to remind him of more stories. And it was a 500-page manuscript built on those sources that I inherited from my great uncle, who was the youngest child of Bill Street, young William D. Street, my great-grandfather.
And then it fell into your possession, and how
I was given the manuscript about 50 years ago. But then life happened. I had a career, and this manuscript just got moved from one place to another. And it was always there, and I always felt an obligation because I knew the family's commitment to having it published. So when I retired, I tried to do what I could to at least publish a copy, a faithful copy for every descendant now living. And it wasn't until I had that ready to go to the publisher, ready to self-publish, that someone suggested I send it to a real publisher, as they put it, and that was the University Press of Kansas, and they have been just very generous with their help in making it a published product that Bill Street would have been very proud of. I feel like I had a mission, and I feel very good about completing it.
As you might expect for somebody whose career was spent out on the plains, this book is just full of one story after another after another. One story that really stuck with me is something that didn't happen to your great-grandfather, but to a friend of his, Jules Van Meter, who got stuck inside a beaver lodge.
Yeah.
Can you tell me that story?
Sure. Bill and Jules were hunting partners for the early part of his time on the plains. One little spell of 3 or 4 days, Jules was by himself in camp. The others had taken the hides to a railhead. And he got curious about what was in a beaver lodge. So one afternoon, he hauled out his trusty knife. This is in the dead of winter, so the beaver pond is like frozen over. And he starts hacking away at the side of the beaver lodge, cutting his way into the beaver lodge, finally makes a hole big enough for him to just kind of worm into, and he looks around and, you know, satisfied his curiosity. But then he goes to back out. And by cutting into the beaver lodge, he actually ended up, like, if you think about how this would happen, he ended up making sharpened ends of these beaver lodge sticks all pointing inward.
Like
and
daggers.
Here he is inside. And he goes to back out, and it's, of course, it's just not going to work for him. So he was there for 24 hours wondering, you know, if the wolves were going to come and eat him halfway up from the legs up or what. And he finally did figure out a clever way of getting out of this pickle. But that was a very close call for Jewel. It made a great story later on, though, like many close calls.
It's a great story.
It is a great story.
Are there any other stories that happened to your great-grandfather that really stuck with you? Like I said, there are dozens and dozens of things that happened to him over the course of his life out on the plains. Is there a story that you'd like to share with us?
Well, you know, one of the stories that I like because of the graphic description is when he and his hunting partners come on a small herd of buffalo. And if you'd like, I can read from the book. He says,
sure.
So they went out looking, they stalked this small herd of buffalo. They shot one of them, the buffalo went down, and the rest of the herd starts running to the west. And then he says, the rest ran off in a westerly direction. They'd gone but a short distance when the scene changed from a peaceful, quiet landscape with only a small herd of buffalo running away from a lone hunter. As if by magic came Indians by the scores. They appeared in groups from every direction and around the fleeing herd. It was inconceivable to we who had been on the constant lookout for game without a thought of Indians that the prairie expanse before us could contain so many concealed living beings. Whether they'd observed us or not, and in all reason they had, they were apparently not quite ready for the attack on the herd, but the running buffalo were met in the west by a strong force of hunters who turned them to the north, and then to meet another line of Indian hunters to turn them to the east, where they were met by other Indians to circle them off to the southwest, and then others to drive them to the west, where the scattering remnants of the herd were apparently wiped out. In the stage setting for the first and only surround buffalo hunt by Indians, it was my great fortune to see, we occupied a position on a little rise of land near the front of the stage. The stage was a beautiful piece of prairie about 3 or 4 miles in extent. There were the wild running buffalo in a compact mass very much resembling a great big black ball rolling over the prairie, surrounded by the half-naked Indian hunters mounted on their hunting ponies. There were a few ravines on the plain into which the buffalo and Indians plunged, disappearing for an instant while the scenes were shifted, with their reappearing into new shapes and shades, finally fading away in the distance toward the southwest. It was a sight that no mortal eye will ever behold again on this earth.
That's Warren Street reading from 25 Years Among the Indians and Buffalo, a frontier memoir by his great-grandfather, William Street. It's just one of the 15 books that the State Library of Kansas selected as the 2016 Kansas Notable Books. We featured many of the Kansas Notable Books on last week's KPR Presents. If you missed that program or would like to hear it again, it's now archived at our website, kpr.ku.edu. This week, we're hearing from 6 more Kansas Notable authors. I met up with them at the Kansas Book Festival, held September 10th, 2016, at the Capitol in Topeka, including Cynthia Mines of Wichita. She's the author of For the Sake of Art, The Story of a Kansas Renaissance. For the Sake of Art tells the story of the friendship between Lynchburg artist Berger Sanzane and Carl Smalley of McPherson, and how that friendship turned the town of McPherson into a cultural and artistic hub in the early part of the 1900s.
Carl Smalley was born in Canton, Kansas, a tiny town, and had a love of art growing up. He would cut pictures out of magazines, and he wanted to be an artist, but he knew he didn't have the talent for it. He worked in his father's feed and seed store in McPherson and had wanted to go to college, but had to stay home and work. And so he was very disappointed he wasn't going to be able to go to college. But the summer he graduated from high school, he went to the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, which changed his life and pretty much the artistic history of a lot of McPherson. He learned about etchings and lithographs and visited the Palace of Fine Arts that had artwork from 27 nations. There was a dome that had 1,000 electric lights on it, and McPherson didn't have much electricity yet. Main Street wasn't paved yet. So it opened up this whole world to him. He bought a consignment of prints, brought them back to McPherson, and convinced his father to let them put a few etchings above the seed bins. And you can imagine what the farmers in McPherson thought of that.
In the seed store.
Yes, yes, in the seed warehouse. He had a little corner where there were etchings and some Rookwood pottery and some first edition books. And then he had the good fortune to meet Berger Sanzane, who had immigrated to Lynchburg to teach at Bethany College in 1894. And Sanzane had studied in Paris and Stockholm and had seen a lot of the world. He also went to the St. Louis World's Fair, but it probably didn't make quite as huge an impact on him because he had seen the world a little bit. And then in 1910, the superintendent of McPherson Schools, they'd built a new school and there was no artwork in the school. So he came up with the idea of annual exhibitions that people would pay admission, a nickel or a dime, to go to. And he knew Carl Smalley had some prints, so they exhibited those the first year. And then he enlisted San Zane's help, and those two men, over the next 25 years, organized these amazing exhibitions that brought in some of Europe's top artists, Whistler and Rembrandt, and George Bellows and Robert Henri and Manet, and half of the population of McPherson at the time was 5,000 people. 2,500 people would get out in the winter in their wagons or horses, go over the dirt roads to these art exhibitions. And San Zane would always give a lecture, and there would be a whole room devoted to San Zane's new work, and people talked about it all year. It made the front page of the local newspapers. It was picked up in Kansas City. New York City often wrote about it. And a journal in Paris said that McPherson County had the highest per capita art ownership of anywhere in the world, and that this Carl Smalley must be the world's greatest art dealer. So it was a very, very unlikely time and place, and but just had all of the right ingredients to form sort of a Kansas Renaissance.
At what point did this go from just a little corner in the seed store to a real presence in the McPherson community?
Smalley's father died in 1918 and left the seed store in debt. It was a really big seed operation. Carl sold the seed store and finally was able to open his own art book and gift shop, which some people said was the finest set shop between Chicago and the West Coast. And that flourished in McPherson from 1918 until he had to close in 1934 because of the Depression and the Dust Bowl. The farmers, who had been great clients, and the school kids would save up their money because they were excited about art, and it just sort of dried up after that. So he sold the shop and moved to the West Coast, where he was a book representative for publishers.
Cynthia, how did you become interested in their story?
I went through the McPherson schools, and I knew there were San Zane paintings on the walls, but I had no idea about the incredible history that school children had actually saved money and raised money to buy all of the artwork, until I was in a Kansas history class at McPherson College and had to come up with a research topic. So the more I found out about it, and I was fascinated that school kids had, you know, raised this money, and then there were some missing etchings that were interesting. They'd been written about in the Kansas City Star, but I couldn't find them. And then to find out the story of the artwork in the seed store was pretty fascinating. And then you throw in Berger San Zane, who was internationally known artist in McPherson County at the time. And it was just a really fascinating story. And so I started the research when people were still alive who remembered Smalley's art shop. So fortunately, was able to interview a lot of them. So I had that research started from back in the late 70s.
What did they remember about his shop?
That it was the meeting place for young people in McPherson. He'd keep the coffee pot on late on Saturday night, and the young married people would go there, and they had art classes. He had a rental library. He had a little tea shop in there. And he would import jewelry and handmade stationery from Italy, and it just had all of these wonderful art objects on, you know, Main Street in McPherson, Kansas.
How would you characterize the relationship between Smalley and San Zane? Were they friends?
Yes, they were very close. They were 14 years difference when they met. I think San Zane was 39 and Smalley was about 25. And they had a wonderful relationship. San Zane needed someone to help promote his art, and Smalley was very good at that. He organized traveling exhibitions and exposed San Zane to a much wider audience. And he's even the one, San Zane was not interested necessarily in making prints, and Smalley nagged him for so long and actually bought him the lithographic crayons. And it was 100 years ago this year that he forced him to do his first lithograph. And that's how a lot of his popularity spread. So in 1916, he created the first of more than 300 prints that Sanzane would do during his career. And Sanzane's daughter, Margaret, gives Carl Smalley the credit for forcing her father to do that. And they wrote, there were some letters discovered just a few years ago, 200 letters written between the two men that talked about the Depression, the Dust Bowl, and discounting paintings and how hard it was to collect from people. And Sanzane's watercolors were going for like $17 at the time. So you really got a look at the business of art and how difficult it was for him to make a living, even though he was teaching at Bethany.
Do you have an excerpt you can read from your book, For the Sake of Art?
Yeah, there's a short one here. This is set in Smalley's art shop in the 1920s. No matter how hot the Kansas sun got as it streamed through the front windows of Smalley's art shop at 221 North Main and McPherson, the proprietor would never consider going to work dressed in anything but a black suit and tie. Even the hottest of summer days could not dampen the enthusiasm Carl Smalley had felt for art since he was a young boy. His intense brown eyes surveyed with satisfaction the paintings that hung on the walls. There was Berger Sanzane in a prominent position, of course, flanked by Henry Varnum Poor, Oscar Jacobson, Albert Krabel, Gerald Cassidy, Philip Little, B.J.O. Nordfeldt, and Anna Keener. These paintings represented more than art, though art was very dear. Every one of the artists was also a friend. A small guest book by the front door was more like an autograph album in which artists had signed their names next to small sketches. Framed etchings and lithographs hung on the walls, but the stock was so great the surplus was neatly stacked in an overflowing portfolio. The contents of the portfolio bore the signatures of such master printmakers as Rembrandt, Whistler, and Millais, as well as his friend Sanzane. These were Smalley's special favorites because they enabled him to offer original works at affordable prices. He remembered with fondness the first consignment of prints he had ordered at the 1904 World's Fair when he was 19 years old. After some cajoling, his father had allowed him to display some of the prints above the bins at his wholesale and retail seed business.
That's For the Sake of Art, The Story of a Kansas Renaissance by Cynthia Mines of Wichita. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our last book is Kansas Trail Guide by Kristen and Jonathan Conard. How did this book come to be?
It all started with Jonathan. He had wanted to have a book out there on Kansas trails and couldn't really find anything that was updated, and then reached out to me, said, hey, would you want to do this? And I said, sure. And then it actually got picked up, and so then we were committed, and now we're a notable book. So pretty big journey.
What is it, Jonathan, that you were looking for that didn't exist?
What I really wanted to do was, there is a lot of information that's available, but there's nothing that really pulled it all together into one spot. And then a lot of the information that was there was simply, information about here's the trail, here's how long it is. What we wanted to do was dig a little bit deeper and provide readers with some history, some natural history, some background knowledge, so that they could not only hike a trail, but really appreciate the area that it was in and, some of the other things about it as well.
I've interviewed other pairs, other authors and co-authors, but you are the first brother and sister team that I've come across. What's it like? I'll ask this question of each of you, but I'll start with you, Kristen. What's it like writing a book like this with your brother?
I guess if I thought 20 years ago if I would be able to do this with my brother, probably not, since we were both, in high school and sibling rivalry and what have you. But we split it up, we divided and conquered, and we each sort of wrote our own portions of it and then compared notes and edited each other's work. And it worked really smoothly. There weren't really any problems. And I think we were able to really support each other and worked well together.
I would agree with what Kristen said. It was a much bigger project, I think, than a single person could take on. And Kristen's a very talented writer, and so I was fortunate to be able to work with her on the project. And so it really was an experience where I think that we worked well together and we're able to do some things that, you know, we might not have gotten to do otherwise.
Yeah. Any of the map work? I did none of, I did the actual hiking and the making the maps along the way, but to actually put it into a finished product, that was all Jonathan. So we balanced out strengths pretty well, I think.
How many trails exactly in this book do you cover?
There's over 80 trails that are in there. And the way that the book's set up is we have what we term feature trails. And so we tried to pick out like the best trails within an area or a park. And then we'll also give a brief description of two or three additional trails as well. So it's a little hard to pin down an exact number, but it's around 80 altogether.
Okay, so let's just take one of those trails and sort of walk me through what it was like writing about that trail.
So I will say the Eisenhower State Park trail at Malvern Lake, the horse trails there, which horse trails have their own unique charms and hazards. So it was actually... You'd start with what was there in terms of like the state park information, what they already had, and so then you figure out where you're going to go. You show up there, and you never know if the trail is actually going to be there, is still there, is overgrown. And that was one. It was there. It was relatively easy to find. It was well mapped out or well marked along the way, and so that makes it really enjoyable. To be able to go along and to view that. And that was one where it was a mix of sort of through the woods, and you get some nice shade if it's too warm, and then you come out onto these rolling hills that overlook the lake, and the wildflowers were in bloom. And so that was kind of an ideal experience for a trail, and it was a really nice one to map and a nice one I think people should visit.
I would say it was always an adventure to show up to a trail for the first time, because there were trails that you heard about or read a little bit about, but you never knew what you were going to get until you were standing at that trailhead. And some of the trails that I'd anticipated going on were just no longer maintained, no longer good trails. And there were some that I didn't expect a lot from, but they turned out to be fantastic trails. And so, you know, when you get there, just kind of that sense of what's this going to be like, it's hard to say. And then when you're actually out on the trails, it's really time intensive, because you couldn't just go and hike it like you normally would. For each loop, you have to map that with the GPS and make sure that you're getting every waypoint marked, each landmark noted along the way. And so you're kind of keeping a running log of notes as you go, trying to take some good pictures as you're out there as well. And then once you've got the hiking done, you know, then the real work started, because you had to go back and research the area, look into the natural history, you know, look up articles related to kind of the history of the place as well. And so it was really quite a process, you know, to kind of tie everything together like that.
Would you say this book is designed with the beginner, intermediate, or really seasoned hiker in mind?
I think that we tried to include trails for everyone. And so we made a point to include some trails that were accessible for families or grandchildren, or people who wanted like a shorter trail but still get to experience some really amazing natural areas. But then we also put in some trails, you know, that are over 20 miles long, over 50 miles long, trails that the serious hiker or serious biker would really want to seek out. So I think that there's really a range of difficulty, a range of length in there, and we kind of tried to provide something for everyone in a sense.
Jonathan, you live here in Kansas in Sterling, but Kristen, you live in California. Are there plans to do a California trail guides?
No. That would be a case. I think California, that's one of the places where you think, or people kind of know about the hiking, and there's a lot of really specialized book. Like, you could just get Yosemite Valley hikes and then Yosemite High Country hikes, and it becomes this really specialized, and it's great. It's wonderful to have these trail systems, but I think it's like that is kind of a saturated market, and I think it's the Kansas trails where it was an opportunity to give something back to an audience that I think people wanted it and knew they wanted it but couldn't find it. And then there's some people who, when they pick up the book, didn't realize how much they would want something like this in their lives. So that was a really neat opportunity. And then it also, I think, gave us a chance to really see the state in new ways that, I mean, you could flip through a guidebook for, you know, different parts of California. You can see what's there. And Kansas didn't have that in quite the same way. So it was a really cool experience to write a book for here.
Say that I am a would-be hiker that would love to take up hiking. I'm saying this not really all that hypothetically, but doesn't really know where to start. Can you give me some pointers and some tips for getting out there and hitting the trails?
Be prepared with a nice guidebook. it's kind of common sense. We do have a chapter in the book, you know, bring water, let someone know where you are. There's not always cell service. Look at the weather, bring some layers. You just never know. But then I would say maybe not to overthink it. You know, start small and see what's there and realize how great it is out there and just kind of build on your experience.
Yeah, I would say find a place that you're excited about, that you're interested in, and just go for it. You know, there's a lot of places out there for people to go. And a lot of these are so accessible, they don't require a lot of specialized equipment or gear or training. You know, they're just areas that you can go and hike for as long or as little as you'd like. That would probably be my advice, I'd say.
That's Jonathan and Kristen Connard, the brother and sister team behind Kansas Trail Guide, the best hiking, biking, and riding in the Sunflower State. Kansas Trail Guide, for the sake of art, bottled 25 years among the Indians and buffalo, and the madman and the assassin. Just a few of the 2016 Kansas Notable Book Award winners, the best new books by Kansas authors or about Kansas, selected by the State Library of Kansas. If you missed last week's KPR Presents, part one of our annual Kansas Notable Book Show, you can listen to it anytime on our website, kpr.ku.edu. While you're there, if you'd like a chance to win a copy of a Kansas Notable book, we've got several to give away. Go to our website, kpr.ku.edu, look under Extra, and then Available Giveaways. Again, that's kpr.ku.edu. Click on Extra, and then Available Giveaways. While you're at our website, consider making a gift to Kansas Public Radio. It's listener support that makes KPR Presents possible. Without it, we wouldn't be able to bring you locally produced programs like this one that you enjoy and depend on. It's that time of year again. We're just about to kick off our fall membership drive. You can pledge now and know that you've done your part already. Listener support is our biggest source of funding, and every dollar makes a difference. And this year, your financial support is more important than ever. If you're already a member, consider increasing your gift or becoming a sustaining member. Again, you can pledge online at kpr.ku.edu. And from all of us at Kansas Public Radio, thanks for your support. The first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is just around the corner. Next week on KPR Presents, we'll set the stage for the upcoming debate with The Making of Clinton and Trump from NPR. Here's a preview.
This is how people describe Donald Trump.
Race baiting.
Charismatic.
Pathological liar.
Larger than life.
And Hillary Clinton?
Policy wonk.
Scorned, strong female.
Very private person.
Seems like a terrible human.
I'm Rachel Martin. Join me for a special broadcast, The Making of Clinton and Trump, character in the 2016 election from NPR News.
Join us for The Making of Clinton and Trump next week on KPR Presents. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.